Hello, educators and learners, and welcome to the Homeroom with Sal podcast, brought to you by Khan Academy. We're an educational technology nonprofit dedicated to bringing a world-class education to anyone, anywhere, and Sal is our founder. I'm not Sal Khan, I'm David Reinstrom. I'm on the content team, and I'm here to introduce today's show. Sal, or the occasional guest host, presents the Homeroom with Sal and Khan Academy Ed Talks live stream shows on YouTube and Facebook, where they interview notable folks from the worlds of education, technology, finance, entertainment, and more. We've taken some of our favorite conversations from the live show and turned them into a podcast. Without further ado, here's this week's show.
So I'm excited to introduce our guest, Dr. Jarrett Bryant. Jared, are you there? And sorry for the technical difficulties. My internet connection has been spotty. Let's just call it that. Jared,
no worries. Good to see you too, Sal. How are you?
I'm doing great. It's been a little while since we saw each other in Houston. It might have been a year and a half, 2 years ago, but good to see you.
Yeah, no, it's a pleasure to be here. Like I said, I want to shout you out. Like, I'm one of your biggest fans. So I've been using Khan Academy since forever. I think you literally taught me calculus when I had to take my teacher certification exam way back when. I had to refresh on some of these difficult topics, and I always had Khan Academy there to help me out. So it's been huge, and I kind of took that with me to my work in HISD.
Well, it's exciting. You'd mentioned that the first time we met, and I was kind of blown away that I guess I am now so old that people who have been using Khan Academy are now assistant superintendents of major school districts. But I think you are also unusually precocious in your career, but that's flattering. And you know, that's the exact hope of why I've always wanted to do Khan Academy and why I wanted to focus on education. Because if you can empower other folks, they can then go on and empower others and do incredible things. And I think you're an incredible example of that. You know, Houston ISD, for those who don't know, I believe it's the fourth largest or third largest school district in America. It's one of the top five, I think.
Seventh largest in the country, yep.
Okay, I was close. Seventh largest in the country. I'm curious, you know, and there's a lot to talk about. I want to talk about post-secondary success and some of the things y'all have been seeing there. But, you know, given the fact that we're continuing through this COVID period, and this has been incredibly hard on, I could imagine, you and your colleagues, how have y'all been dealing with it? You know, take us through what's been going on for all of y'all and what's been going on through for the district since last spring, and how have y'all navigated the crisis?
Yeah, well, fortunately, you know, I work alongside thousands of incredible colleagues, tens of thousands of amazing teachers, our senior leadership, our superintendent, our trustees. And, you know, in the middle of a crisis, we all rolled up our sleeves and did whatever we could for students. So, you know, obviously we shut down the schools in March and we were virtual for quite a long time. We've transitioned back to in-person learning, but, you know, going virtual in the middle of the spring semester, you know, was really eye-opening for me because you realize how fragile some of the processes are that exist out there to get our students into higher education. And that happens to be my work in Houston ISD, is focusing on what can we do to get students college credit while in high school? What can we do to ensure that students receive college counseling that's amazing, that's effective, that'll take them to where they want to be, wherever that is? And of course, when you go virtual, that's all in jeopardy. But I will say that the great thing about working in Houston ISD is that we're very forward thinking. We've been thinking about online learning for a very long time, even before my time in HISD, which has been about 8 years. All of our high school students had laptops. We had been talking about what they call the flipped classroom or blended learning, which is, you know, a fancy way to say you can use your laptop to study for class before you even go to school. We've been talking about these things for a very long time. As you know, Sal, we're very huge fans of Khan Academy. In fact, we had a series of campaigns over the last few years called the You Khan Do It campaign, or your Khanathlons, because we really believe in virtual learning and everything that comes with it to supplement what's going on in the classroom. So even though it was challenging for everybody in the country, I would say that it was really, you know, quite the experiment to kind of use all these tools we've been building for years and putting them to the real test, which is making sure that our students are ready to move forward, to go beyond and achieve their dreams, regardless of any crisis.
And you mentioned you're kind of one of your focal areas is preparedness for college. What have you seen? You know, I was listening to the radio this morning, and they're talking about studies around the number of kids who are enrolling in college this year is 20% lower than what we see in normal years. And it's disproportionately, I believe the number for low-income kids or kids from historically under-resourced groups is actually at 30% lower rates of college enrollment. Are y'all seeing something similar from the graduates of Houston ISD?
So we're looking at that data too. Those are nationwide trends, and there are a lot of reasons for that. More so than ever before, we're hearing on the ground that students are having real thoughts about, do I need to earn money to support my family, or do I go to school? Do I go to a four-year that's outside of the very large state of Texas, or do I stay somewhere more local, maybe go to an open enrollment college that, you know, ultimately will change their entire life trajectory? But we had a lot of bright spots, even in the midst of the COVID pandemic in March. I support a very special program called Emerge, which focuses on our high achieving, low income students. And we work with them to get into highly selective schools. And one of the things that makes that program great is that we invest in these students and we send them all on an out of state college tour. And we had a cohort of students that weren't able to attend an out-of-state college tour. We had a lot of students that had a lot of anxiety around how are they going to make it to the finish line and get to, you know, these highly selective schools that are far away. And, you know, for that program, our numbers were unchanged. We had actually a higher percentage of students enroll at highly selective universities all over the country. But that's because we made strategic investments into students that really needed an extra layer of support. But it doesn't always look like that for other districts and schools across the nation. So we're feeling the pain too, but we're really trying to roll up our sleeves and figure out, well, what can we do to change that? Because we want students to have all the options that will help them achieve whatever their life ambition is, whether it's 2 or 4 year college or whatever that may be.
Yeah, and on both fronts, kind of the COVID and the getting ready for college front, post-secondary success side, you know, it looks like we have another 6 months of weirdness. I think we're finally seeing the light at the end of the tunnel with hope around a vaccine. How are you at the district thinking about that? What are the conversations you're having, both in terms of how do you keep kids learning? How do you help fill in any gaps for kids that might have been disengaged during the pandemic? And then how do you ensure that y'all continue to beat the national trend of making sure kids aren't dropping out and getting to college?
Yeah, I mean, it's a lot of hard work, and I'm just one person that works in a giant orchestra of professionals that are really thinking about how can we make the most of time if that time learning has to be virtual. Right now, you know, we have some students that are in-person learning, we have some students that are learning online, and we're trying to make the best of it. You know, obviously, we're going to have weirdness for a very long time, but I think the other piece to this is that school districts don't operate in a vacuum. We're also subject to a lot of policies, and this isn't just a Houston ISD thing. This is a school districts across the country thing, where a lot of districts are wondering, well, how will I get funding if it makes sense for us to be virtual for longer? Or how do I approach whether or not I want my schools open if our counties are saying one thing and other folks are saying a different thing? So it's really a giant, big logic tree to figure out what we're going to do. But I would say that us, like many districts, are really focused on, well, how are we going to make sure that our students are safe? How are we going to make sure that they're receiving the best education possible? And, you know, it's really enthralling being around colleagues that are willing to do whatever it takes, whatever that looks like, to make sure that our students are learning, they're engaged, and they're receiving a high quality education. And, you know, I do want to give a shout out for things that we've been thinking about for a really long time, well before this pandemic. We've really seen the value in personalized learning to supplement what happens in a classroom. So that's why we entered in a partnership with Khan Academy a couple years ago. We were the first district in Texas to sign on for such a partnership, because we really saw the beauty in what a product like Khan can offer. Not that I'm a Khan commercial, but like I said, I was a kid that used Khan Academy. So I really believed in it, and it's something that I brought into my work. And, you know, most of my contemporaries don't have that background. But, you know, to date, what's neat is that we give PSATs and SAT exams for free to our students during the school day. So we have a ton of data as to, you know, where kids are at. We're able to use that data to to personalize their learning experience. This is something that we valued for years. So when it came to put that to the ultimate test, we still utilize tools like Khan. And what's great about our formal partnership is being able to look at the data to see, okay, well, you know, how many minutes are students using the tool? And what we saw unequivocally is that students were using the tool more than they ever had. Even we did all these amazing things. We had our Khanathlons and all those things I mentioned for years. But this was something that they needed, and this was something that we wanted to push on them too. Because like I said, I was worried about how are we going to get these students the college credit that they were going for on their advanced placement exams? How, you know, we have a lot of schools that offer associate's degrees while in high school. How are they going to, you know, be able to finish up their coursework to get that degree? You know, we have all these students that had all these post-secondary ambitions as a 16 or 17 year old. And for all that to be kind of put on the whim of something none of us have control over, it's a lot. But we're thankful that we have incredible college counselors out there on the field that are helping think through and not to mention advocate. I think the advocacy to higher education is another piece to this. You know, we could talk about the amazing things going on in classrooms, but systemic changes need to happen too. And it reminds me a lot about when I was leading similar work during Hurricane Harvey in Houston. Another piece of this is appealing to the universities to make sure that they know all the barriers that especially low-income students face when they're thinking about what's next after high school. So they really need to meet us halfway on a lot of different things. And we did that. So we did that. We had the instruction piece. And then we had our digital tools that we use when it made sense to use them, because we had been investing in it for years. So in that way, we were very prescient in our thinking.
No, it makes a lot of sense. I mean, I'm curious about Houston ISD in particular. You know, we've been hearing nationwide numbers about digital divide, about even where the digital divide is closed, there's still, we've been hearing 5 to 10% of kids that we're just having trouble reaching. What are those numbers looking like in Houston? What percentage of kids have had trouble accessing, you know, digitally? How did y'all address it? And then even with that support, you know, what percentage of the district are y'all having trouble engaging with?
So I wouldn't have specific numbers on that. And we have incredible professionals in our IT division that really took the lead on some of the logistics. But I will say that it was a high priority. It was a top priority to ensure that there wasn't a digital divide in terms of devices. You know, there was a point during this pandemic where every student that requested a device got a device. And that's something that we were able to leverage. So that way, as instruction needed to be digital, we were able to do that. So for that, we're really proud of. And then, you know, obviously the philanthropic community and the community in general wanted to do whatever it takes to really fulfill this need for the students in Houston. And for those of you who don't know, in Houston ISD, 8 out of 10 students at least qualify for free reduced price lunch. And the number of students that are going through economic troubles certainly increased during this pandemic. So really you have 200,000+ students that have more needs than they've ever had before when they were already in underserved communities. So it was a beautiful thing to see how many organizations, public and private, and the city and other folks stepped in to make sure that we address those gaps as much as possible.
That's super, super powerful. I'm curious, you know, and I get this question a lot, and I'm fascinated to know your answer as a kind of you're a practitioner. There's obviously a lot of negatives from COVID. It's a lot of them are obvious, and there's probably some ones we'll discover. Have there been some silver linings? And do you think there's going to be some long-term implications of what we've just gone through that are going to last well beyond, you know, 2021, 2022, 2023?
You know, I hope so. I hope that some things change. You know, I know that all of us want to go back to January of 2020 or December of 2019, but I'm someone who really cares deeply about urban education. And let me tell you that things weren't perfect back then either as it relates to education for students nationwide. I think if anything, that this crisis really unveiled a lot of inequity and access to things and made it worse for the students that already got the short end of the stick. So I do hope that certain things can change. You know, some of that falls on school districts, other that falls on the state. I think that we could evaluate the way that, you know, we provide funds to schools, especially during crises. I think we can think about, you know, the role of, you know, curriculum, the ways that we can, you know, finance technology in a sustainable way. I hope that there are a lot of conversations that just show that when things like this happen, we really need systemic level change. And then there are some practical things that I really do hope change too. Now, some students really struggled in the digital learning environment, but I do want to point out something that I think was shared on this show by another guest. Some students really thrived in this environment, and maybe they didn't anticipate that, or maybe they did. But in some ways, being able to learn in a virtual way really allowed students to achieve things that maybe they wouldn't have otherwise. So I think that it's incumbent upon education officials and administrators to think about, well, how do we know the type of learning modality that will help students achieve at the highest levels that they can? And how can we think about adjusting our programming to making sure that students have access to that type of modality? You know, I think back to the, you know, one room classroom, not that I was ever in a one room classroom, but I think a lot of practices that we still, you know, use in education nationwide go back to that way of teaching. I don't think that classrooms, you know, across the nation look very differently than they did 50, 100 years ago. And isn't this an amazing time to think about what classrooms could look like moving forward? There are all sorts of little nitpicky things that I could pick on, but I'll give one concrete example that I'm passionate about. So just as, you know, an individual, I'm very passionate about access to community college. And one thing that always boggled my mind was that community colleges often put requirements for students to take courses at the college. They need to score a certain number on the test, like a SAT or whatever that is. Otherwise, they'll need to go into remedial coursework. And the problem with that is when you look at open enrollment institutions of higher education, the graduation rates are abysmal. Sometimes they're in the single digits. So whatever the system is, it's not working. In some ways, I think policies like that can gatekeep students from pursuing, you know, a degree that may have nothing to do with math or reading. So isn't this an opportunity to say, hey, how about we change that and figure out ways to get students taking courses that excite them right now without that course right now? And that's what happened during COVID. A lot of community colleges across the nation waived those requirements simply because students couldn't access those exams. But I would be curious to know what that data looks like. You may see more students thriving in their degree programs than ever before. And that's because we were forced to do something that we had been doing just to do something. And we're doing it completely different now. Things like that, I think, are all over the place. The opportunity's right, not just in education, but in industries across the field. I think we're reevaluating what remote learning and what remote working can look like. And imagine if school districts and organizations really stop thinking about who's the best person for the job close to our office. How about who's the best person for a job that lives in the entire United States, especially for small districts and small organizations? I think that could be game changing. So those are just a couple of examples. I really hope some things do change for the better when it comes to our students in underserved communities.
That last point you made is actually, I mean, all of those were really interesting points. That last point you made was fascinating because I actually never thought about that. Obviously, a lot of, you know, we as a Khan Academy is actually a distributed organization. We have a headquarters and we're kind of thinking about to what degree, you know, how that will be afterwards. But I hadn't fully thought about that notion that even school districts, which you view as a very local thing, even those might be able to tap talent at a national level. Which could be quite powerful. And, you know, some of what you talked about, community college requirements, I agree with what you're saying. It will be interesting to see the data when they waive those requirements. I'm also, one of my pet projects is trying to figure out how we can get kids the credit for things like not even just the remedial work, but the college algebra or that first English language or writing course before they graduate high school. But that we could have a whole conversation on that. You know, we're getting questions in coming on social media, and anyone watching, feel free to put your questions in for Jarrett. I will try to get to as many of them as possible. But we're getting a lot of questions about people curious about your career pathway. I guess, you know, I alluded to, it seems like you're on a rocket ship in terms of how quickly you're progressing. You're the first question is from Susana Garcia Dominguez from YouTube, who is a regular on this show. Hello, Dr. Bryant. How did you know that you wanted to go into administration instead of being a classroom teacher? And I know you started as a classroom teacher, but tell us how that pathway works. I think most people know how to become a teacher. Most people don't know how to become a assistant superintendent.
Yeah, I think that's a really great question, because here's the thing. I was one of many people that went to college thinking that my only path to success would be to be pre-med or to think of these very conventional things. And I was going to do that. You know, I went to a place
My mother still thinks my only path to success is pre-med. But anyway, sorry, I interrupted.
It's fine. But the thing is that I didn't know that my job existed. I did know that teaching existed. I took a course in college that changed my life. It was called Solving the American Education Crisis. And it was about all these inequities that happen in urban school systems that I hadn't thought about. That wasn't my experience. I thought schools were fine. They're not fine. And I felt really compelled to go into a classroom and to experience that firsthand. And then I think the thing that changed the game for me was that I wasn't so much thinking about being in the classroom versus not being in the classroom. I was thinking about what gives me energy. And I would say the turning point for me, because, you know, I did have a lot of steps between, you know, what I do right now and when I was a classroom teacher, but the lesson I learned remains exactly the same. So I was transitioning out of the classroom and I thought that I'd go off to be, you know, what they call a management consultant, basically put together spreadsheets and PowerPoint decks for a living that are, you know, really expensive and really important to some people. But anyway, I met somebody that changed my life because he was founding an organization that really targeted those high achieving students in underserved schools to help get them to highly selective universities like Stanford or Harvard or wherever that is, because those schools get full rides to students who are low income. So anyway, I chose to drop everything that I was doing to make that program work. And I think what I learned from that experience was you need to figure out where you get that energy from. I never felt that energy again, or at least as strongly as when I spoke to the founder of that organization about that special program. But that energy, that feeling of desire, that feeling of wanting to make a difference in this way, I just had to pursue it. And it ended up looking different over the years. I realized that it wasn't so much that particular program I was passionate about. It was really speaking up for the underdogs in society and making sure they get their fair shake and they get resources. So then it looked like putting counselors in all of the high schools. Then it looked like thinking about how do we get as many low-income students as possible to pass an advanced placement exam. Then it looked like, you know, XYZ. But the common denominator is I stopped listening to incredible people that I really admire, because there are still people that tell me I should be doing X and Y, but I always follow my heart. And I know that sounds trite, but I was very lucky that something spoke to my heart. And for the first time, I stopped following my gut and I just did it. And it could have totally failed, but it didn't. And I truly think that that's what made the difference for me.
And on the other side of that coin, you know, what are the things that you think you're doing? And I know this is a hard question to answer, but what do you think are the things that you're doing that have given you that success, that have allowed you to be an effective, not just educator, but administrator as well, and for people to recognize that?
I think the number one thing is you have to be around people that are willing to take a chance on you. You know, even if I were to consider different roles in education or whatever it is elsewhere, some people aren't willing to take a chance on somebody that thinks about things unconventionally. It goes back to what I mentioned before. I'm probably one of the only contemporaries in my building that used Khan Academy as a high school student, obviously for obvious reasons. But I've been very fortunate that I've had mentors. I've had an amazing boss who really been willing to take a chance on somebody who maybe didn't have the most conventional background for something, but they saw something, they saw a spark, they saw potential, and they were willing to take a risk. So that's something that I think made the difference for me, was that, you know, I did have somebody who signed off on me taking on, you know, this job. I think I was 25 at the time. And some people would say that's crazy. You know, I recently, I made the Forbes under 30 list, and I finally got some Twitter haters. I felt like a mini celebrity for like a minute. And I saw some of the things that were put out there, and it's like, wow. But I had mentors that really saw beyond what people will say on Twitter and that sort of thing. And they just really believe and invest in somebody. And I wasn't perfect. And I had people that were willing to do what it takes to make me see things that I didn't see in myself. So I value that. I really aspire to be that for somebody one day.
No, that's incredibly powerful. And I think it's going to be inspiring to a lot of people who are watching, people of all ages. You know, in the time we have left, and maybe this kind of combines both parts of our conversation, your journey and also the journey of education generally, you know, what are the things that you're most worried about right now, either in your own life or in education or in your job? And what are the things that you're most hopeful about? And any other advice you have for those watching, especially the young people out there?
You know, I'll keep it real. I'm a little worried that people are going to really romanticize what it was before this pandemic. I think that we're all really wanting things to go back to normal. And I just hope that we don't overcorrect and go back to the things that really started inequity. Remember, inequity didn't start with the pandemic. It was already there. And that's probably a theme that comes up in a lot of different fields. It really accelerated things that were already there. So the flip side, the positive thing about crises, whatever that may look like, is it's an opportunity to put a shock in the system, to reflect and to do things better. So while I'm very concerned that people are going to want to go back to the way that we did things, including the things that really didn't help propel our underserved, I am really excited about this idea that we'll look at technology differently, that we'll think about education differently, that we'll learn how to operate school systems, school funding, school finance at the state level, even federal policy. There are so many things that I want to advocate for that I don't think people would have listened to for 2 seconds had this pandemic not put it on their radar as an issue. And I know we're running out of time, but maybe next time I can talk about those particular things. So stay tuned, my friends.
We look forward to that. Well, Jarrett, thanks for joining. And, you know, I know there's a lot of work. You have your work cut out at Houston ISD, but it sounds like y'all are doing better than most. And I think we're going to see a lot more from you in the education world doing really great things.
Thank you, Sal. It was a pleasure to be on.
If you want to hear more of Homeroom with Sal or Khan Academy Ed Talks, subscribe to this podcast and tell a friend. If you want to support the work we do here at Khan Academy, visit khanacademy.org/donate. We're a nonprofit, and we appreciate your financial support in making sure that our materials can reach as many learners as possible. That's khanacademy.org/donate. That's our podcast, folks. Your host is Sal Khan. This show is produced by my wonderful Khan Academy co-workers, Kevin Dangor, Stephanie Yamkovenko, Dan Tu, Irene Wang, Anthony Nelson, Felipe Escamilla, Irene Chen, Ken Jones, Fail Lundberg, and me, David Reinstrom. Our intro theme is Time Flux by Revolution Void, and our outro theme is Onward by Poddington Bear.